They were wimps, chucks, New Zealand chickens. That's what those disciples were. Maybe that's why Jesus asked them to take a little boat ride, as if it were a riddle. Why did the disciples cross the lake? Granted, it was a change in their itinerary. Instead of bringing the realm of God only to the Jews, like any good Jewish Messiah should know, he wanted to take it to the Gentiles on the other side as well. Why, for God's sake? Well, whatever his reasons, the trip across the Sea of Galilee showed that the disciples certainly weren't Kiwis. The Sea of Galilee isn't a sea at all, and it isn't much of a lake. I mean, Lake Taupo is 4 times bigger and deeper. And I've seen the Sea of Galilee during a storm, and yes, it's choppy. But the disciples should be grateful. They've never had to cross the harbor bridge on a Vespa with a fuzzy white dog strapped to their back during a sou'westerly, which is my mode of commuting. And if a boat ride on our, as the gospel describes, brought them to their knees, they should count their lucky stars they've never had to fly into Wellington on a calm day. For that matter, they should give thanks that they don't have to sit in this nave where you have been and had to repeatedly endure my inviting you into exile from the church's traditional understanding of Jesus and God. Ever since Palm Sunday, when I began my exile by declaring Jesus just a man, I've been tossed in the storm of the implications of what this means to be a Christian or the church. The result, 5 sermons later, last Sunday at 8 o'clock, I brazenly preached to the 4 people who got up early that God has been, that I have been praying to all my life, and the church has been praying to for the 2 millennia prior, is in our postmodern worldview both redundant and homeless. Science has given him very little to do. And the Hubble telescope, which has managed to find the very edge of the universe, which I find astounding, hasn't yet been able to locate heaven. I've got to hand it to you, though. I haven't seen any of you jumping ship during this voyage. I know you could have just dismissed me as a Jaffa, just another you-know-what American. Americans seem to like stormy weather. Look at the Episcopal Church defying the rest of the Anglican Communion by first ordaining a gay man as bishop, then blessing same-sex marriages, and this week, in case you haven't heard, electing the first woman primate in the history of the Anglican Communion. And not just any woman, but a scientist with a postmodern view of God and the church. Maybe you don't dismiss me because you remember that New Zealand was the first place anywhere to consecrate a woman as bishop. Maybe you don't dismiss me because you're aware that gays and lesbians have considerably more rights, though not yet enough, in New Zealand. But they have more in New Zealand than they do in America. And maybe you don't dismiss me because after my first winter in Auckland, it's clear that you aren't troubled by stormy weather. Perhaps that's because you live in the city of sails. You know that if there isn't a little weather, you're not going anywhere. A lively wind is immensely preferable to the doldrums, or certainly to a dead calm. So, where are we going this week? What does the story of Jesus calming the storm have to say to those of us in exile? If it does have anything to say, it certainly isn't in Jesus telling the storm to be still. Living here, we know how quickly the weather can change. Any resident of Auckland can go outside at any given point and say the same words to Jesus, "Be still," and they have a pretty good shot of being lucky. Jesus, for Mark, had authority over the weather. But that wasn't what was important to Mark. He didn't think miracles created faith. Like me, he thinks faith has the possibility of making miraculous things happen. For us in exile, to those who don't experience a God who is going to come rushing in to rescue us whenever we find ourselves in rough waters, this is a difficult story. Sure, for Mark, it was possible. See, for Mark, this was a classic story of two gods at war. The very name for sea in Hebrew was the name of an evil Babylonian god of chaos and death. The good God, the good guy of Israel, Yahweh, had often been depicted on one of his wrathful days as being in the storm. Jesus calming both of them was giving a new understanding of God. This is captured best in the original Greek, where the disciples are described as having two kinds of fear. They showed cowardice before the gods of sea and storm, and fear as in awe of Jesus, captured in their question, "Who is this bloke?" Since we dealt with that question five sermons ago, what else might the story say to us who are living in a rather fearful exile? We could use some reassurance from this story. We live in a frightening place, where we no longer have a heavenly parent in the sky to take care of us. This is even scarier than the time that eventually comes for all of us, when we realize we have no earthly parents to care for us or to fall back on. Knowing we are alone, responsible for ourselves, and there is no higher power for protection is not a warm, cozy spot to be in. Learning that meaning is not external to life, but must be discovered in our own depths and imposed on life by an act of our own will, is not a place we go to voluntarily. We are all too aware that life is not fair and will not necessarily be made fair in this life or in any other. So how can this story help us to live with this reality now? Is it able to bridge drastically different worldviews to be of any use to us? I'll let you decide. But I think, ironically, the most valuable part of the story is Jesus being asleep at the helm. If he was in the Navy, that would be a serious offense. He might be made to walk the plank. But his taking a nap while all hell is breaking loose around him could be a helpful model for us. Mark was probably writing this in Rome, while Nero was busy crucifying Christians along the roadsides, dousing them with pitch and setting them on fire as particularly gruesome street lamps. To Christians at the time, it must have seemed like God was taking a nap. But is it any better now? Is God asleep while innocents die cruel death? Why hasn't God intervened to stop AIDS and malaria, war and terrorism, famine and natural disaster? Where was God when twin infants were being battered to death by a family member and Mangere. Those of us in exile cannot blame God, who never was, for permitting such evils and tragedies. We are forced to look to our own accountability. But if you're like me, you're quickly repelled by such a notion. I defensively ask, what can I do? I'm not the cause, and I don't have the resources to respond. Here's where a napping Jesus is helpful. He is the picture of the calm in unbridled anxiety. Edwin Friedman, a rabbi and family therapist, wrote a book years ago called Generation to Generation, and how to become and remain healthy in a dysfunctional family system. And he points out all family systems are dysfunctional. It's just a matter of degree. The trick, he explains, is to remain a non-anxious presence in the midst of hysteria. We refer to it as napping, non-anxious presence, napping. An example of napping is taking your fiancé to a family Christmas dinner to introduce him. Such occasions are fraught with pitfalls. Too many toasts and too many stories that accompany such moments can create a great deal of anxiety in the future bride. What will my fiancé think? Should I warn him? Should I explain them? How do I explain my mother? Or my Uncle Albert? Or my nephew Stanley? If the bride-to-be arrives too anxious, you can imagine what happens. It is likely to make the event even more bizarre. But if she's a non-anxious presence, trusting what is good in her family, as well as their idiosyncrasies, and trusts her fiancé to sort it all out, it can be a fun and joyful occasion. Now, this sounds good and simple, except those around us don't want us to take a nap. They want us to participate in the craziness. I once asked my mother how she always knew how to press my buttons. She got that smile of hers and said, "That's easy, dear. I installed them." Friedman conveniently uses the analogy of a boat to explain it. When someone decides to be a non-anxious presence, that is, nap in the boat, this is seen as confrontational by others. The person napping is usually the healthiest member of the family. Her healthy behavior of not getting sucked back into the family's dysfunction is a challenge to the others, to either become healthier themselves or jump overboard. Eventually, if she remains napping, they will all do one or the other. But first, they conspire to get the napper to wake up. They rock the boat in hopes that they won't have to change. They rock the boat to raise up fear in the non-anxious presence, for it is fear that returns us to our old dysfunctional ways. Friedman argues that to change a dysfunctional system, be it a family, church, community, or the world, begins with the power of one. The more we seek to become and remain healthy, the healthier those around us become. Now, if you find this hard to believe, go back to the disciples' boat. See the man napping? Now do you question the power of one? This is the man who let nothing draw him from spiritual health, even unto death. This man knew that no matter what tragedies or evils befall us, nothing can take that which we experience as God, love, life, and being from us. So there's nothing to fear. We are free to do as he did. Seek God in this journey we call life, and offer our healthiest selves to a broken world that is so desperately in need of our compassion, our hope, and our love. To seek to be as healthy as Jesus is our Christian responsibility. And it's not beyond our ability. For you see, we are no less human than he. We are the second coming of Christ to this broken world. So desperate to know a God who cares. We do that by not letting the storms in our life cause us to retreat from our mission to reveal faith, hope, and love that is within us.